Welcome to Insights and Indicators. I'm Jason Thomas, Carlyle's Head of Global Research and Investment Strategy. And in this podcast, I share our observations and opinions on the economic landscape, as well as insights from research being conducted by our team here at Carlyle. Today, I'm joined by Jeff Nettleman, Carlyle's Global Head of Distribution, for a discussion about the Fed's recent rate cut, various topics in financial markets, and also just to hear Jeff's impressions of the sentiment shared by limited partners and investors at our recent global investment conference held last week here in Washington, D.C. This episode was recorded on September 23rd, 2024, and the discussion reflects composite portfolio data and analysis of recent government reports that are accurate as of that date. Before turning to Jeff, I just wanted to make some observations about last week. So first, I wanted to speak a bit about the recent Fed decision. Interest rates were too high when the Fed met last Wednesday. They're still too high today. More rate cuts are coming. The debate among FOMC members in the lead up to the meeting was about how best to sequence this series of rate cuts. And they could not reach agreement in the weeks leading up to the meeting. This is very unusual. Typically, a consensus is formed among the FOMC 7 or 14 days before a meeting. So the meeting itself is just a formality. This was actually a live meeting for the first time in over a decade. It was also the first meeting where there was a dissenting vote cast since 2005. So different perspectives. The basic argument was about how the Fed should respond to what has been a very significant market repricing. When the Fed met on Wednesday, futures markets priced in 10 rate cuts over the next 12 months, so that you could say the market has really gotten ahead of itself. So the question is, should the Fed push back on this by only cutting 25 basis points, forcing the market in some ways to recalibrate their expectations, or to effectively lean in by delivering a 50 basis point cut? And of course, those who wanted to lean in won out. And I think it's interesting to consider the scale of easing that has been achieved. So even though base rates, money market interest rates, have only fallen by 50 basis points, if you look out the forward curve, the effective base rate, which is the lowest rate at which borrowers can swap their liabilities over the next 3 years, has already fallen by 150 basis points. So three times as large as the cut itself. In addition, when accounting for the narrowing of credit spreads, the effective interest rate today paid by single B borrowers has declined by 300 basis points. So six times as large as the actual rate cut delivered thus far. And I think most consequentially, from an economic perspective, you have the 30-year fixed rate mortgage, which has declined so far by 170 basis points year over year. And as the spread between mortgages and treasuries normalizes over the next few weeks, you could have mortgage interest rates in October of 2024 that are about 225 basis points below where they were in October of 2023. So, you know, I think that this sets up for a situation where by delivering this amount, this quantity of effective easing up front, the Fed has created a lot of optionality for itself. I think it's certainly going to follow through with rate cuts in November and December, but thereafter in Q1, there's going to be an opportunity to reassess the situation. How have some of those interest-sensitive sectors like housing responded to all this effective easing? To what extent has output, employment, and of course prices, you know, rebounded in ways that actually make some of those rate cuts priced into 2025 unnecessary? So again, I think it was an interesting decision. And I think it is a way to look at this is that this is a front-loaded easing, again, that creates much more optionality than would have existed had the Fed just sort of followed a formula of perhaps 25 basis point cuts each meeting or each quarter, as some other analysts had suggested. So with that, I want to turn to Jeff. Thank you so much for joining us this month.
Hey, can we spend a second on the paradigm of higher rates just for a little bit?
Yeah, great.
Yeah, so, you know, you won't love this analogy. I don't think you're the Josh Allen or you're the Jim Kelly, but I would give you the Tom Brady of calling rates over the last couple of years. You kind of talked about the mortgage market, and I'm fascinated about the wealth creation and the embedded value in fixed rate mortgages in the US, and call it the wealth effect. Go a level deeper, and how should we think about the mortgage market and Americans' ability to spend over the next year or two based on the embedded value of the mortgage markets?
Yeah, so I think that one of the reasons, of course, that consumption did not decline as interest rates went up is because of the extent to which people have locked in very low mortgage rates. Of course, corporate borrowers have also locked in low rates through their fixed rate bond liabilities, but really it's the US mortgage market. So, you know, you look at about almost $13 trillion of mortgage liabilities at the household sector. The effective interest rate on that is still only about 3.9%. So mortgage rates rose to, you know, about 7.7% at the peak, but that was of no consequence to households that had locked in those long rate mortgages. And at the peak, households were saving about $500 billion a year relative to a system where mortgage rates adjust, you know, as you see in other countries. Maybe they adjust instantaneously, or maybe, you know, after a relatively brief period. So this is very significant. But of course, having interest rates so high, market rates so high, meant that a lot of people felt that they couldn't sell their home. They couldn't move because the most valuable asset they had was, in fact, a liability, that this long-term mortgage and the savings derived from it. The issue with the mortgage market, there's an asymmetry. You can always prepay without penalty. So when rates fall, people refinance, they get those savings. But of course, they're under no obligation to get out of the mortgage. However, when you do prepay, you always have to prepay at par. So a way to think of this, as rates went up, someone has a mortgage against their house, they would have to pay 100, or, you know, an average like 300,000, but the market value of the mortgage was only 73, or, you know, maybe 220,000. So that increment is essentially the lost wealth if they sold the home, moved somewhere else. And of course, people were not inclined to suffer those kinds of losses. Now that you have mortgage interest rates, last week it was 6.1%. Again, some normalization in spreads relative to treasuries suggests it could be 5.75% next month. Now you get the sense that there could really be a big upturn in transactions. People now, it's close enough to their effective interest rate that they're willing to sell. Buyers on the sidelines now are, you know, this has reached an affordability threshold. They're willing to buy. And if you start to see those transactions pick up, of course, you would also expect to see a pickup in construction activity. Of course, it's cheaper to buy cars. It's going to be cheaper to finance inventories. There's a lots of interest sensitive sectors. But I think when looking at the effect of this policy change, it's really the housing markets where we should pay the most attention. And again, it's a source of not just incremental growth, but perhaps some incremental price pressures as we go into 2025.
You know, Jason, I'm always amazed at the robustness of the U.S. consumer to spend, to lever. But let me ask you, this is tangential, maybe adjacent, and you would remember this because you know history. You know, Jimmy Carter's presidency up to Ronald Reagan's presidency, you had risk-free rates at 20%. Literally, you had a 20% risk-free rate. And then roughly we've had 40 years of declining interest rates. So most of the people running companies, investing in the financial markets, honestly, have never lived with higher rates for longer. This is not going to be like an existential discussion, but do you think that people even can process a higher paradigm for longer? Because you say the end of the beginning in your paper, but do you think people are prepared to live in even a 3.5%, 4% base rate, you know, yield curve that goes out in the future, or should that not even be a worry?
Well, there's a lot to unpack there, as they say. So let me just, first off, I think what is interesting to note is that the extent to which companies have been able to weather this storm. So the credit performance of leveraged corporates has been very strong. There are pockets, of course, you could say it's software, some medical technology, IT services, digital applications, where the purchase price in 2021 was very high. And so even companies that only have 30, 40% debt in their capital structure, the debt to EBITDA is so high that, you know, there are still some issues there. And we'll see how that sorts itself out in the coming years. But on average, companies have managed through this very well. And, you know, what I think is interesting is that when you look at 10 rate cuts in terms of the market expectations, if that were coming in the context of expected recession, a deep downturn, well, then that makes sense, right? The Fed would cut 10 times or more if that's the sort of economic environment we're facing. But because we've seen this tightening of credit spreads over the same period, the market indicators of recession are suggesting very little risk of that. So then you wonder, well, why is it that the market is pricing such aggressive easing when credit investors are suggesting the future looks pretty bright?
And that's what comes back. And the equity markets are suggesting
exactly
the world's a good place too, right?
Exactly. Valuations, when you look at bottoms-up forecasts in terms of earnings, you know, all these market data are suggesting, again, a bright future. So you get why this disconnect. I don't think it can be explained outside of this idea of mental anchoring, that rates seem too high today. Again, as you said at the top, they are too high. We still need, you know, another 50 basis points or so, in my estimation. But the idea that they're, you know, 300 basis points too high, again, that's not something that is validated by the data.
Yeah. Hey, Jason, and this will be my last one in this realm. And you touched on this a little bit at the conference, and we'll eventually go back to the conference. You know, the Republicans and the Democrats don't really agree on much, but now they agree that deficit spending is okay, that deficits are going to be fine. Should I, or when should people worry about deficit rates, reserve currency, or is that just a fool's errand to actually be focused on that we can't balance the budget in the United States? Like, how do you think about U.S. deficit spending and where we are?
So this is a question that came up a number of times with investors last week. And I think what's so interesting about this discussion is that it feels almost binary. In some sense, it's everything's fine, there's nothing to see here, or there's going to be some massive blow up. And what's actually likely to play out is that a deficit that's this large, it's about 2.5 times larger than it was 10 years ago when you adjust for the state of the economy. It's a treasury that is injecting about $1.5 trillion of incremental liquidity into the economy relative to a decade ago. This sort of explosive path for the debt growing much faster than the economy is one where you're going to see gradual, you know, upward pressure on inflation, again, from that incremental liquidity injected in the economy, gradual repricing as risk premia get incorporated into longer term bond yields. You know, it's something that is going to have a, I think, material effect, but it's going to be relatively slow moving, in my opinion. And eventually, it is actually through higher rates that you get the change in the political dynamics so that people are actually willing to deal with the problem. And I think, again, when you look through history, when you look cross-sectionally at other economies, the only time you see deficit reduction on the required scale is when it's perceived as necessary to reduce borrowing costs. In the early 90s, of course, President Clinton sold his deficit reduction package as a way to bring long-term U.S. interest rates below 7%. So, you know, again, this is the sweetener. Tax increases are painful.
Yeah.
Spending cuts are painful. Nobody wants to enact those. But if you have a sweetener in the form of, well, you're going to be able to afford that home because mortgage interest rates are falling, you're going to be able to get in that car because auto loan rates will come down, well, then now this is something that actually is appealing. And so, again, this is not going to happen anytime soon, it doesn't seem. But one, it wouldn't be surprising if, you know, by the time of the 2026 midterm elections, the need for fiscal consolidation is something that, that actually does become a topic of conversation as people realize that this is necessary to pull rates down a bit. And again, when you have this change in market sentiment with the Fed cut and rates are expected to go down, everyone thinks rates are too high. Of course, this is the last time in the world you would expect Republicans and Democrats to come up with a plan to address a problem that doesn't even seem to exist.
Yeah. Hey, you know, to come back a little bit where you asked, you know, I want to say thank you to the over 400 LPs, our partners, who spent a couple of days with us in Washington, D.C., a huge amount of their time and their effort. I think, Jason, as you and I would agree, we spent a lot of time on the presidency, a lot of time on geopolitics. I think there was some agreement that we didn't really know who would be the president of the United States up until, you know, in November. But, you know, on the presidency for a second, and you went through this a little bit at the conference, when you think of the policy outcomes of a Harris presidency or a Trump presidency, just briefly, for those who weren't there, how would you think of the key just policy outcomes between the administrations come November?
Well, as I said at the conference, I think first and foremost, it's important for people to recognize the degree of consensus that has emerged in Washington on some key issues. Fareed Zakaria was at the conference, and he said something to the effect of, you may not like Trump, but you do have to appreciate the extent to which some of his narratives have really taken hold in DC. And I think that's true, especially with regard to trade policy and with regard to industrial policy. And certainly we saw that in the Biden administration prior to the 2020 election. Then Vice President Biden blasted the Trump tariffs as ill-advised, costing U.S. consumers, U.S. farmers, giving strong impression that he would get rid of them on day one. Of course, instead, increased the number of products that were subjected to tariffs, increased tariff rates, of course, also imposed export controls. And then industrial policy, you saw, of course, the CHIPS Act to subsidize domestic semiconductor fabrication plants. And then, of course, the Inflation Reduction Act. While that was focused on green industry, renewable energy, which, of course, is not something President Trump would have supported or proposed, it had many provisions just to catalyze reindustrialization in much this and also some protectionist policies that are, again, very much in line with President Trump's broader narratives. So, again, I think it's important to recognize that we're in a new era where these parties seem so polarized on so many issues that there is more commonality than perhaps we suppose. I think that the biggest difference, of course, is going to be in terms of where the revenue is going to come from in the event that a revenue needs to be raised. I think that the Democratic Party in the past had a significant political vulnerability in terms of a willingness to raise taxes on a broad basis. So over the years, of course, they've essentially eschewed those sorts of policies. And so it's very focused on what you could say is the top one half of 1% of the income distribution. Proposals to increase capital gains rates, corporate income tax rates, and then also potentially have a mark-to-market function where assets are revalued and any change is then subject.
Hey, on that one, I'll stay and I can't wait to see the proposal on mark-to-market taxation. So I'll be very curious to see how that will work in practice.
And clearly, the market does not believe any of this is going to happen, right? You know, if you deduct the increased corporate income tax, and then you deduct the amount of earnings that are available for shareholders because of those tax increases, the market would be down 20 to 25% if it assigned high probability to these policies coming into effect. So again, this is mostly something that is just out there to say how you could hypothetically address the deficit if you were forced to.
Hey, so
but I don't think it's going to be pushed very, very hard.
I get it. Hey, along the same lines, you know, when you think of the current FTC stance, and you've done good work on PE exits, and you've been talking about PE exits this week. Do you think there's a distinction between the administrations on what the world for PE exits, FTC, again, lazily, you'd think easier Republican than Democrats, although some of this stuff is compressed so much with the parties. Do you see a real distinction on, call it exits, liquidity, FTC oversight, depending on who's in charge?
I think it's going to be more marginal than many people suppose. So I would say a Republican administration, somewhat better environment in terms of slightly less scrutiny. But this is an area, again, where you see changed attitudes and more consensus. I mean, I think the simplest way to think about economic policy is that for 40 years, both parties generally oriented economic policy around the subject of the consumer. So trade policy, regulatory policy, competition policy, all really aimed driving prices down. Now it seems that there is no longer, in the case of competition policy, the need to have demonstration of explicit consumer harm. You can now, you know, just have apply antitrust laws if you think a practice is anti-competitive, again, without demonstration of consumer harm, or if it just results in companies that look too large or have too large market share. So I think, again, this is something where at the margin, you will see a difference, but it's perhaps not as great as we would think using, you know, your schema from 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah. Hey, my last crystal ball question on this. You know, it seems popular to be critical of all things China right now, right? That's just a popular notion. Do you think there's a window for difference on China policy, economic policy, tariffs, or you think that collapses together, like you just said, on some of the other things?
Yeah, I do think there's a big difference. So if you say that the potential Harris administration would be more inclined to raise revenue, again, on this, you could say top one half of 1%, of course, the Trump administration is going to seek to raise potentially a very significant amount of revenue through tariffs. I think tariffs are extremely likely, and additional tariffs in a new Trump administration. Obviously, he likes tariffs personally. He has a very broad unilateral authority to impose tariffs. The issue with regard to China is that when you subject imports from China to much higher tariffs, the question is there a method to this madness? Is he just putting in tariffs for the sake of tariffs, or is it tariffs as a bargaining chip? And I think this is true when you look at tariffs more broadly. The former USTR, Robert Lighthizer, has suggested that the tariffs, imposition of tariffs, would be used as a bargaining chip to essentially have a second Plaza Accord, to have a coordinated intervention from central banks to reduce the foreign exchange value of the dollar. Now, these may be good ideas, they may be bad ideas, but again, there's a method to the madness. That is using tariffs as a tool to get that desired outcome. And that's, I think, the big question with regard to China. Is this going to be just an effort to, you know, substantially complicate supply chains, intermediate good imports, just global production networks? Or is it going to be a way to reach some sort of bilateral agreement? And I think that that's, again, that's very much an open question I wish I had the answer to.
No. Hey, so again, let's head back to Washington, D.C. of last week. You and I sat through some interesting presentations on AI, and, you know, maybe in a couple of years, my avatar and your avatar will do this call together. But when you think about, you know, you and I lived through the technology revolution of 1999 and the backbone of the internet and what came out of that. And when you think of analogs of 1999 and lessons learned versus the AI revolution today, what rings similar to you and what rings entirely different?
Well, I think the most obvious similarity is the equity market response. And this is, you've seen graphs that compare the price performance of NVIDIA over the past couple of years to Cisco. And the commonality there is not just obvious in the way the graphs look. It's that in both cases, there was this recognition that there was a very key piece of hardware that was serving as a bottleneck to the future. And so in both cases, you had, you know, extraordinarily strong sales and earnings growth that was, you know, extrapolated far into the future, in just the sense that I'm not really sure how to play this technological revolution, but I know for sure that the product produced by this company is going to have a huge role in it. So again, I think very similar in the way that people have responded initially. Secondly, you know, I would say that you do see a distinction in that much of the spending that's occurring this time around is actually equity financed. It's through the very large cash piles of these hyperscalers, you know, mega cap technology companies that have almost insatiable demand for data centers necessary to train these foundational models. In the past, of course, the internet, telecommunication, mobile telephony, a lot of that was debt financed. And as a result, when that went bust, when the capacity came online too soon, too fast, you had default rates that approached 20%. So to the extent that you have similar, you know, issues with too much investment happening too soon, it's going to be more of an equity market phenomenon. And that's why I think in recent months, you've heard a lot of analysts start asking tough questions about, you know, where are all the revenues, where are all the applications associated with all the spending? Because the amount that is being put to work today is really startling. But, you know, the CEOs in the space, rightly or wrongly, they consider themselves to be in a technological arms race. Yeah. The first mover here, you know, advantage is really critical. And they're convinced that the risk of underinvestment far outweighs the risk of overinvestment. So we'll see. But I think that that similar, you know, need to scale now is something that we saw very obviously in the late 90s. When you think about CLEX, or you think about, again, mobile telephony, it's like we need to build our network first as the only way to actually compete over the long term. Finally, I would just say what interests me about all this spending is the implication that AI actually is going to be inflationary in the short run before it eventually perhaps proves deflationary or, you know, significantly disinflationary. It could be in 8 years, in 10 years, you know, as you have ASI, as it was described, they really were no longer facing the same resource constraints. We could be very much in a deflationary sort of environment, but there is this interim step between now and then where so much societal resources and also just construction employment, when you look at the data centers, is being consumed to build this future. So I think people are very focused on long run disinflationary trends. Again, could take hold for sure. I'm not disputing that. But again, I'm suggesting over the next few years, it could be quite the opposite effect as you see all this investment, construction activity, and all of the real resource.
Yeah. Hey, and Jason, we didn't go down this path. We could do a whole nother episode on second order effects on energy, energy demand. But it was curious last week that, you know, Constellation Energy announced that they were going to have an offtake agreement with Microsoft to relight nuclear in the United States, which I think was Three Mile Island, if I have that correct. And it was kind of a nonchalant, you know, news spot that didn't get a lot of hype. But it is odd that we're talking about, you know, nuclear power now relative to your point of what this is going to take. And I didn't even, you know, is this going to be deflationary or inflationary? And as you said, possibly inflationary first, deflationary. But I guess we can end here. When you think about the second order implications of energy on what you just talked about, spend a second on that.
Yeah, I think it's been fascinating over the past few years as several very large companies like Microsoft have hired directors or head of nuclear engineering. Why were they doing that? Well, of course, they recognized that the power demands, just the computational, the energy intensity of these AI processes is such that they really had to start planning out how they were actually going to power these facilities and processes. So this is something that could have been anticipated years ago, again, as they were sort of going through this planning. But I think when you look at what's expected in the future, it's been estimated by some that the data center capacity that's being added today could consume more electricity by the end of the decade than several small economies. So we've just been through this period where we recognize the need for energy transition, the need to spend trillions of dollars to essentially redesign energy systems, re-engineer industries and industrial processes for a net zero future. But that has not accounted for the fact that it's not just replacing existing energy sources, it's now a need to dramatically increase the amount of overall primary energy produced and the energy that can be consumed on the electric grid. So I think it's the interaction of the spending on AI with, again, just the energy transition that has really, really complicated things. And I think, again, been a huge spur to substantially more investment and, you know, potentially inflationary pressure over the next few years.
Yeah. Hey, Jason, with that, I think we hit on almost the key themes from the conference. So it's always good to see your face, and I appreciate having the conversation with you.
Yeah, Jeff, well, thanks so much for joining me this month. It was perfect timing after our investor conference, and I certainly hope everyone in attendance enjoyed it as much as it sounds like we did. But on behalf of the team here at Carlyle, thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join us again for our next episode of Insights and Indicators.